This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 139 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, welcome back home. I know you were recording on the road the last couple of times, so.
That's right. Oh, it's quite a challenge when you're in hotel rooms or someone's private residence and you don't have the comfort of the recording studio. But we get by, back home and happy to be home.
Well, if you haven't seen it, I can always post a picture of you in the hotel room with your soundproofing devices.
Bedroom pillows.
That's always a good thing. But we should get started. We got a lot of news. We've got a drone junkyard, pilot training. Of course, we've got FAA news and Easter eggs. Our first story comes from motherboard.vice.com. This online drunk, this online drone junkyard lets UAV owners swap and exchange parts. UK drone builder Andrew Spaxman founded Drone Junkyard in January of 2015.
It's an interesting concept. I guess Spaxman found himself with lots of little parts and bits and pieces and components and things and stuff that had accumulated over time. So he thought it might be a good idea to create an environment where people could buy, swap, and sell unwanted UAV parts.
And it's closed country-specific Facebook groups, which is kind of cool. So you're not shipping things overseas or whatever. And in the UK, it started out with, it's got 2,484 members swapping parts. That's a lot of parts swapping, I think, Max.
It sure is, but it's a great idea to reuse parts, also make available to others components that they may need if they're building a drone. And I see David recently, he's expanded into some other countries. Doesn't have quite the membership yet as he has in the UK, but a couple other countries have been added to the fold.
Yeah, there's a US, Canada, Australia, and an EU, but you crash an airplane, you salvage the parts, you might need something. Somebody might need that one if you upgrade your drone. I mean, it's a really cool idea. You know, another one of those, you know, you and I would be much richer if we had thought of something like this than coming up with doing a podcast. But
although I'm not so sure that this is a money-making proposition for him, I'm not sure. Because they're closed Facebook groups, you've got to request memberships. Now, you can go to the basic website, which is dronejunkyard.co.uk, and what you then do is you click on one of the country flags to go to the closed Facebook group for that country, but because it's closed, you have to join, so you can't really see what's going on in there. But he does mention that he expends some energy to try to keep it on the up and up. I guess there have been some spammers and folks who have tried to kind of use this for different kinds of purposes. So he tries to keep it restricted to the real enthusiasts that it's directed to. So it's a great idea. I think that's pretty clever.
I agree. All right. Well, let's talk about issues. Evidently, the Air Force has got issues. This was from shepherdmedia.com. UAV pilot training struggles continue. The GAO, or here in the United States, the Government Accountability Office, issued a report. And we'll have a link to the show notes to the report, which is in typical GAO fashion. The title is Unmanned Aerial Systems, Further Action Needed to Fully Address Air Force and Army Pilot Workforce Challenges.
Sort of rolls off the tongue, huh?
Yeah. And in other words, they got more airplanes than pilots, which is kind of amazing.
And the GAO made some recommendations a couple of years ago. In 2014, they issued a report. And what they say in this recent report is that the United States Air Force and the U.S. Army, well, they've implemented some of the recommendations they'd made in that 2014 report, but not all of them.
So back in January of 2015, the Air Force, and I believe we talked about this on the show, released a Get Well plan. That just sounds so wrong. Get Well plan. To increase the number of instructors at Holloman Air Force Base to 100% by the end of September 16th. By May of last year, only 63% of the instructor positions were filled, and 84% of that goal as of February 2016. So they're doing as well as hiring pilots as the FAA is issuing 333 exemptions. Well, I think the FAA is doing better than that, but this is a real issue that we've got not enough instructors, which means not enough combat pilots. You know, normally you pull instructors from combat pilots and you want a surplus, you want to hit your combat pilots, but then you need a surplus of pilots above that to train new pilots. So the Air Force is targeting 100% by 2017, which is what, 15 months too late?
Behind schedule, certainly. But it, you know, it speaks to the problem of not having enough pilots of the skill requirements that they have. They do mention that the Flying Training Squadron, the 558th Flying Training Squadron, is looking to increase class sizes. They want to increase the number of pilots, which, you know, as we say, you have to have pilots to have instructors. I don't know, David. I don't know if it's an issue of people who are suitable candidates aren't interested in this kind of a role, this kind of a job, or if the Air Force isn't doing what it needs to do to reach out to people who could be, you know, potential RPAS pilots. I'm not sure.
I think there's a stigma now attached to RPS pilots, and I think there needs to be some sort of massaging of the role. The PR is pretty bad. You know, flying planes from boxes is not what people want to join the Air Force to do, even though there's probably a lot of people who'd like to fly airplanes from boxes, but aren't necessarily the Air Force type. And the other part about it is, unlike the Army, which uses enlisted personnel to fly UAVs or remotely RPASs, the Air Force still insists on officers, you know, and the Air Force always seems to have more officers than enlisted. At least that's what it always feels like. They might need to seriously consider following the Army model, which is to move to more enlisted personnel flying RPAs.
Interesting. There's a few other points from the GAO report. One is just on promotions. And the GAO noted that while the Air Force monitors the promotion rates of UAS pilots, it hasn't analyzed the factors it says that may relate to their low promotion rates. And until they do that, it's unclear whether the Air Force actions to raise promotion rates are appropriate. So, I mean, a little interesting tidbits. It's a nice report. It's not too overly lengthy. And as David mentioned, we'll put a link to the report in the show notes.
So the next one sort of is near and dear to my heart. And this is from DVIDS Hub, which is the military news, the Defense Video and Imagery Distribution System. And this was FAA handpicks Horsham pilots to help refine UAS detection display. The FAA wants to develop a UAS detect and avoid display for unmanned aircraft systems at the FAA William J. Hughes Technical Center in Atlantic City. And it's pulled volunteers from the 111th Attack Wing, which was formerly an A-10 unit based at Air Force Reserve Station Willow Grove, and they actually operate out of buildings my father helped design.
Oh, there's the connection. Okay.
The 111th was the Pennsylvania Air National Guard A-10 unit, and it was they were a resident at my father's base at Air Force Reserve Station Willow Grove. And in fact, the 111th actually took over most of my father's buildings. They don't actually fly out of the field anymore. They fly from the field. They have all of the equipment to fly their Reapers remotely. The aircraft don't actually live at the base anymore because the runway shut down. So we've got the FAA in New Jersey, which is right down the road at Atlantic City, and they're working with the pilots to study how the displays and how the pilots interact with the screens, the monitors, the technology when they're piloting these systems.
So this is kind of a human interface sort of study, is it?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. That's why you're the engineer and I'm the historian.
Oh, dear.
The FAA knows how people react when they're in an aircraft. It's safe to conclude that people may not react the same way when they are not, in a sense, an avoid issue in imminent peril. When you're in an airplane, you sort of are jeopardizing your own life. You're not really that way in a UAV or you're flying a remotely piloted aircraft. Would you agree with that, Max?
Yeah, and this now kind of makes a little more sense to me about this quote from Kevin Williams in this article, and he is the FAA Civil Aerospace Medical Institute research psychologist. Again, getting back to that, you know, that interface between the display and the human being. And Williams says, our task in this study is to look at the displays used to provide the pilot with the information that is required for them to remain well clear of other aircraft. Basically, what we're talking about is the minimum information requirements for those displays. And I would imagine, I mean, this would have application in, you know, civil as well as military and even commercial and hobbyist applications.
Agreed. I mean, this the FAA is not just doing this for military. They're using the military as a subject, as a base of subjects, but these applications for sense and avoid technology are going to grow across the board. And again, it's you don't know how people react when they're not in a life-threatening situation, even though it is a life-threatening situation to the other aircraft or the people underground underneath the UAV. And if we're going to integrate them into the NAS, this is another thing you have to think about. So you might need to give a screaming warning signal a lot earlier to a UAV pilot than you would to somebody else, so they have time to react. So interesting stuff, and congratulations to the 111th for being part of this. And it's nice to know life goes on a little bit at the Grove.
Well, life's going on across the pond in the UK as well, where they are obviously, along with many others across the globe, how do we regulate unmanned aircraft? We have this article from Flight Global, UK calls for realistic approach to UAV integration.
The UK wants to permit beyond line of sight UAV operations at all altitudes by 2020. At one point sounded far away, but that's really not that far away. It's right around the corner. But the Department of for Transportation, the DFT, wants to be sure that the regulations are robust and realistic. What does that mean? Paul Cremin, the head of the UK Aviation Operational Safety and Emerging Technologies at the DFT, said, quote, this is a disruptive technology, changing the way we think about aviation, but we have to be realistic about safety and security. And told the industry, quote, please don't wait for the regulators to sort this out for you. Interesting, putting it on the operators to come up with the rules and regulations. How un-FAA-like.
Well, another aspect of this is the conversations the DFT has had with the public. And this sounds like more interaction than, you know, we see in other countries. And in those conversations, they found that the public has faith in state-controlled UAVs. So it'd be government and, you know, that kind of a thing, that the public has confidence in most commercial operators because they feel like, you know, if it's a business operation, it's being taken seriously. And for business reasons, you want to fly safely and economically and all of that. But that the public does have concern with hobbyist flying, which is, I guess, not unexpected. Also, the DFT finds that kind of the consensus out there in the public is that they expect there to be drone registration. They expect geofencing, things like age restrictions on use, mandatory insurance, and licensing of retailers. So that's the input that the DFT is getting from the public.
Which is kind of interesting. Good news for commercial operations. Concern with hobbyists, I sort of have to agree with what the general concern is. Though mandatory insurance, I would love for that to be. That will keep my universe going. But licensing of retailers, that's an interesting, I don't know how well that actually would fly here in the United States.
That's kind of a little different, sort of an animal. The DFT says that they're going to be issuing a complete report on this conversation they've had with the public in April, and then there'll be a period of public consultation in June. And all of this leads to a UK government strategy on permitting operations later this decade. So, again, they're seeking a lot of input and then, you know, taking their time to arrive at that the regulations are going to end up with sometime down the road.
So let's cross back across from the pond to talk about more regulations. I hope this, folks, doesn't bore you every week, but we've got to talk about this stuff. And this is from Lexology.com. The Senate bill calls for certification of unmanned aircraft. As you know, we did talk about the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2016 that was left the House of Representatives committee and then immediately went back in under hiding, primarily because of the issue with the privatization of air traffic control. In the meantime, the Senate has come out with their own authorization act, and there are some interesting aspects that directly affect UAVs, etc. The first one in the Senate's version will require all small UASs to meet design and production standards within 1 year of this being signed off on. That's going to be interesting.
It's kind of a form of type certification.
Oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. You're right. It's standardization. I don't know how well in this growing universe where everyone is trying to top each other. I don't know how standardization will work in the Parrot DJI universe, but it's interesting that that would, and most of these are, a lot of those are made overseas, DJI being China. I don't know how they're going to work on standardization here in the United States.
And then there's some requirements on manufacturers besides meeting design and production standards that in order to sell, that the manufacturers would have to certify that they're compliant. Random production samples would be tested to ensure compliance. And the manufacturers would also have to provide a sample of the UAV to the FAA for review. So this is kind of a stronger flavor of type certification, if you will, than certainly than we saw from the House of Representatives.
Yeah, well, I think the House of Representatives had something in there, but they were really more concerned about air traffic control. This one is a little different. We'll have to monitor it. Max, I challenge you to contact your senators to see what they have to say about it, and I'll reach out to mine.
I write them all the time. There's some other interesting things in the Senate version of this bill. One is that operators, including those of model aircraft, would have to pass an aeronautical knowledge and safety test. There would be some exemptions under 0.55 pounds. Also, pilots under 13 years of age, if they fly under the supervision of an adult who has passed the test.
Oh, I'll never have that happen because I'm still 13. So that's just
young at heart.
The FAA is to create within 2 years a new operating certificate for unmanned aircraft package delivery operators. Boy, is that target marketing? Do you think Amazon has sent? Do you think somebody's got Amazon's number? Not anything else like videography, but specifically unmanned aircraft package operators.
Yeah.
9 months for the FAA to establish a new rule for micro UAS, which is under 2 kilos or 4.4 pounds, with no pilot certificate requirement. Oh, I'm off the hook. I can fly my micro quad without my license. And last but not least,
9 months to develop standards for UAS operations by institutions of higher education, colleges, universities, that sort of thing. And then, interestingly enough, I love this little provision that if the FAA missed the deadline, that 9 months deadline, then those institutions can operate as if they were flying model aircraft. So there's some incentive there. So again, for those of you, especially maybe outside the U.S., what this comes down to is there was a House version of reauthorization, a Senate version of reauthorization. Since these things won't all get worked out by the time the funding runs out, there will be a continuing resolution to fund the FAA. Meanwhile, the House and the Senate will end up getting together and trying to hammer out a common bill. So none of these things are guaranteed to remain in final form, but we don't know what it'll look like exactly. It'll certainly have a lot of elements from both the House and the Senate versions of the bills.
You can trust us to follow it because we've got to talk about it on two shows. So it definitely affects our lives, Max.
It does. It does.
Well, this weekend, if you're a Christian or it's sort of celebrated here in the States as a spring holiday, it's Easter Sunday. And lo and behold, I'm driving to work today and almost drove off the road because my morning talk radio show comes up with a story about an Easter egg drop. Now, most people know about Easter egg hunts, and growing up as a kid, we used to have an Easter egg drop where they would fly a Bell Jet Ranger over a big field and drop eggs from it, and I'd go chasing after them, and you get as many eggs as you can. It's kind of like the old KRP turkey drop. Well, believe it or not, and this is from our local newspaper, the Courier Post Online, drones to drop Easter eggs on Cherry Hill. An organization has gotten permission. The Impacting Your World Christian Center plans to host egg drone drops events for kids in Cherry Hill in Pennsylvania. And the FAA approved FlexRite Solutions to fly drones with thousands of candy-filled eggs and drop them on fields for kids to go running after. Happy Easter, everyone. The drones have made it, have replaced the Easter Bunny.
Oh, isn't technology wonderful? You know, if I was, I'd put rabbit ears on the drone or something like that, you know, a little pink nose. How could you resist, you know?
So, interestingly enough, we did some research, and FlexRite Solutions offers UAV pilot training courses besides dropping eggs out of drones. I really, really want to go Saturday to the Philadelphia one to watch how this works. It's not going to happen, but I really, really want to go watch eggs drop from drones. I think this is cool.
Yeah, it would be interesting to take a look at, you know, how they treat this from a safety standpoint and just sort of coordinate the whole thing. So you don't think you'll be able to attend, huh, David?
I'll try. I don't know. I mean, it's the holiday weekend and we've got other things to do, but, you know, and I can only, you know, convince Professor Vanderhoof that, you know, another drone thing. Even if it is Easter eggs right, being dropped by drones.
Okay.
So, Max, do we have a video of the week?
We do. This is Flying Demo Highlights Commercial Potential of Drones in Wales. Just recently in March, at Wales Snowdonia Aerospace Center, there was this event, a week-long event. It was hosted by the company Kinetic and in partnership with the Welsh government and Snowdonia Aerospace. And what they did is they demonstrated how drones can take a look at, can tackle environmental issues and other commercial challenges. They did some demonstrations and captured them on video, two different scenarios, one looking at using drones in fisheries protection and the other in managing the threat of erosion on the Welsh coast. So we'll have a link to the video in the show notes. It's kind of one of those, you know, good use for drones stories.
We do like those.
We do like those. And I think they're helpful sometimes to show other people who are either not convinced of the social value, let's say, of drones, or just need a little bit of positive reinforcement. It's, videos like this are sometimes useful for that. So we'll have that in the show notes.
And of course, it's pretty.
Always a plus. David, how about some feedback?
Of course, we get a lot of it. And just to chime in, we like feedback. We like you sending us stories. And that's always feedback at the UAVdigest.com. The first one was from Brent. A new UAV can launch from underwater for aerial missions. This is a submersible quad that can remain submerged and then activated. And this is kind of like a fleet ballistic missile. You just sort of sit it under there and then you activate it and away it goes.
Yeah, and this comes from some research at the Johns Hopkins University, the Applied Physics Laboratory there in Laurel, Maryland. And this is called the... this is a great acronym. Well, I say that tongue-in-cheek. This is an acronym that's maybe kind of stretches it, but this is the Corrosion-Resistant Aerial Covert Unmanned Nautical System, or Krakens?
Krakens.
Krakens.
As in Kraken, the Greek mythological monster that could fly and lived under the sea. Kraken.
Ah, so now that's why you're the history guy, and I'm not. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, so now it makes a lot of sense.
Kraken, or Krakens. It's the Louisiana version of the Kraken. It's a Krakens.
Cool.
But this is a cool video and a really neat spy kind of tool that you could almost see Navy SEALs wanting to grab a hold of and use, you know. So it's interesting that corrosion is one of the biggest things, you know. How do you survive, or a quadcopter survive in seawater, that salt environment, you know, it's, and you have a multiple tool. So very cool. And our next one was from Ron from Georgia. As he says, I enjoyed the UAV Digest show as always. A few months ago, I wrote you about the potential danger of LiPo batteries. You mentioned it on the air at the time, which was cool. I've been doing some more research in it and thought I'd send you some more data. Well, that was an understatement, Ron. Boy, did you send us data. And he basically is concerned. The more, like anybody else who goes reading lots and lots of stuff, and I know Ron's background, so he would be, he's coming at this with an excellent knowledge base. He sent us a link of lots and lots of links on fires and LiPo batteries. And we need to, it's a good reminder to all everybody out there that it's one of the technologies that's kind of worrisome about UAVs. And it's also being used by people who are not necessarily trained in it. My favorite example is my best friend Wookie, who has a quadcopter, almost set his garage on fire because he left out his LiPo batteries. And I would call Parker a experienced, well-versed drone pilot. But, you know, LiPo batteries are interesting technology and one of those things that we probably will need to follow for a long time. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, you know, this makes me think of if you're cutting firewood and you use a chainsaw, you have to have a lot of respect for that chainsaw, and you can't take it for granted because you'll get hurt one way or the other. Many LiPo batteries are kind of similar to that, in that if you don't understand how to treat them, how to charge them, how to use them, how to store them, you can have some serious, serious problems. And some of these videos, and again, we'll put, of course, links in the show notes, really demonstrate that. There are a couple of them where they take a LiPo battery, something that would be used in a DJI Phantom or that sort of thing, and puncture it with a nail. And the result is incredibly dramatic. You've got discharge of huge amounts of gas. You've got heat. You've got fire. So not to, you know, make everybody afraid of their batteries, but you need to understand things like if you're charging them, charge them in a LiPo bag. You need a vault or some storage device that's appropriate. You have to watch for swelling of the battery. There's just all of those kinds of things. So if you're flying drones and you're not kind of tuned in to the issues surrounding LiPo batteries, you really need to, because otherwise you could very easily end up hurting yourself or someone else. So again, thanks for Ron for sending in the links to those videos. They really do make the point.
And we, of course, want everyone, of course, always to fly safe.
Absolutely.
And that this is one of those... Doesn't hurt to be reminded that we sometimes aren't playing with toys. We're playing with things that can hurt you. So thanks for Ron for that. I guess, Max, with that, we are running just about on time. So I guess we better say goodbye.
Yes, I want to thank everybody for listening to the UAV Digest. You can find us at the UAV Digest. com. If you'd like to take a look at the show notes for this episode, they're at the uavdigest.com/139. I have links to all of the news items that we talked about, a little bit of supporting information.
And of course, I joined. You convinced me and I joined.
I know you did, didn't you? And you've been pretty active too.
Well, I'm inviting you. We would like you to come to our Slack team, and you can find information about that at the uavdigest.com/team. Slack is a networking book where it's invitation only. So if you'd like to become part of the Slack team, and we really want the UAV Digest one to grow, you just send us your email address and Max will send you an invite and you can join the conversation. We're looking to grow the group. These are people who have the same interests as you and like-minded. And so we're looking forward to that. So again, that's the uavdigest.com/team. If you don't want to participate that way, you can always follow us on Twitter at @UAVDigest, Facebook, which is facebook.com/theUAVDigest. And the other more important ways is send us feedback. And it doesn't necessarily have to be feedback. It can be a news story you saw, like my local Easter egg hunt kind of thing. Please do send us that. Or if you want to send it to Max or I, or you have a question for us, it's max@uavdigest.com and david@theuavdigest.com. On iTunes, leave us a review. It's important so other people can find us. Likewise, at stitcher.com. And of course, if you want some UAV Digest stuff, which is really cool, you can get some swag at our Cafe Press store or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/theUAVDigest. And of course, all of the above have links at our website, which is theUAVDigest.com. And with that mouthful, I'm done. I wish everybody a great week. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
And of course, thanks for listening.